On Point, hosted by Peter Van Aartrijk. Conversations with interesting and informative experts on technology, branding, culture, social media marketing, and other great topics.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Peter Van Aartrijk, your host for On Point, a podcast brought to you by our good friends at Wells Media, which includes Carrier Management, Insurance Journal, and other publications. And today, I'm pleased to be chatting with Bill Wilson, a good old friend. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Peter.
Yeah, Bill, well, thank you. Gosh, I don't even know where to start because there's such a rich body of work to work with here. I know if folks can do this safely and they're not driving in their cars right now, they can go to insurancecommentary.com to get a peek at what Bill's been up to, including the blog and a book, which is called When Words Collide, Resolving Insurance Coverage and Claims Disputes. And Bill, you've had quite a long history around the insurance industry with the Big I, of course, and the launch of Virtual University. And before that, when I first met you, you were with the Insurers of Tennessee, which is the Big I of Tennessee. And you were running education and technical affairs down there. So anyway, welcome again to the show. And let me ask you, what does RTFP mean?
Well, diplomatically, it is read the full policy.
Oh, I see. Read the full policy.
Right. Yeah.
I remember I was sitting at a conference at which you received a fine award for your accomplishments, and that's what they do to people like you and me over time. You get awards if you hang around long enough.
Well, you know, it was the Jeff Yates Lifetime Achievement Award, which I. The best as I can gather, if you live long enough, you'll probably get it.
No, there's no way I'm getting that. You, it was well deserved, my friend.
Thank you.
And it's a high honor because we both knew Jeff Yates well as the former executive director of the Big I. Read the policy, and there's a cadre of people. I don't know how small or large the group is. I suspect it's fairly large. Around the industry, you kind of subscribe to that same mantra. What are the words behind that, Bill? Why do you feel so passionate about RTFP?
Well, there's in fact, I was blogging today. I'm at my blog usually every Wednesday afternoon. People that subscribe to my blog get an email with whatever I blogged about that week. So I hadn't blogged about anything. So I was trying to do a couple of posts this morning, and one of them, in fact, was. Claim that had been denied by an adjuster because it was a homeowner's claim. They had property in a mini storage, self-storage warehouse, and the adjuster was trying to say that there was a 10% limit on property, not only that was in a storage warehouse, but was off your premises. And if you actually read the policy, read the full policy, you'll find that there's no such limitation in that particular ISO homeowners edition. There is now. They added one in 2011, but the insured had an earlier edition, and the adjuster just never read it or read it and didn't understand it. I'm not really sure what happened, but that's the point. That you can't give coverage opinions. You can't adjust claims. You can't sell insurance unless you know what the policy covers, and the only way to know what it covers is to read the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because, not funny, haha funny, but I remember when I used to work at the Insurance Information Institute and later at the Big I myself in communications roles, we were always pleading with consumers and with agents and others to just read the policy, be an informed consumer, et cetera. I get the sense that very few people actually do that. And by people, I don't mean just consumers, which is probably asking a lot, especially when the policies are in all capital letters. But agents as well. I mean, I may be throwing the vast majority of them under the bus here, but I just fear that they're not doing that, and yet they're counseling people, you know?
Yeah, it's it's funny that you, not to diverge from the question, but I didn't realize that you had worked for the Triple I.
Yeah.
I had my last week my blog was me slamming the III because they had published an article about based on a news story where a guy's window, I think, on his vehicle was damaged by a catfish that that fell and hit his windshield. I forget the exact circumstances, but they said that if you don't have comprehensive coverage on your auto policy, you don't have coverage for hitting an animal. And that's mm-hmm. simply not true. At least I mentioned in the blog that I've seen it worded in a way that is true. But in the ISO personal auto policy and most mainstream standard auto policies, there's no such thing. It basically says that if you have comprehensive coverage, which is exactly the wording ISO uses in their business auto policy, that if you have comprehensive coverage, we're going to charge this as a comp claim and not a collision claim, which means anyway a smaller deductible, no rating penalty, etc. But if you don't have comprehensive coverage and only have collision coverage, which is pretty rare in mm-hmm. personal auto, but not so much in business auto where you have a choice between comprehensive and specified perils. Anyway, if you only have collision coverage, it's still covered. If you hit something, it's still a collision. You just happen to, with an animal being, you're hitting an animate object and not an inanimate object.
Right.
So what the III posted, and I've seen it from several insurance departments on their websites where they say if you don't have comp coverage, you don't have coverage if you hit a deer or whatever mm-hmm. kind of animal, and it just simply is not true. It's in my book. Yeah. I probably talk about RTFP, but about folklore is not fact. People that, you know, I've always heard that, blah, 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 that's not good enough. You have to look at the contract language to be able to make a coverage opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was at the III bill, I had such choice sound bites as, if you don't have renter's insurance, you're inviting financial disaster.
Yeah.
So clearly I wasn't long there because I didn't come up with catfish stories, but
it's funny. No. When I read that, the article allows comments, so I made a comment and explained why that wasn't accurate, and my comment has been awaiting what do you call it,
approval.
Yeah, approval or whatever the term is that it's waiting moderation, I think, for the past 3 weeks. So I don't know if they just don't monitor their articles or if they don't think I'm right and don't want to add my comment, or maybe it would reflect poorly on them. I have no idea, but it's still bad information that needs to be correct.
Well, Bill, that's one of the things I think people admire about you, and I do too. It's like you're an equal opportunity offender. It doesn't matter what organization has an opinion. If you have a different one, they're gonna certainly hear about it, and it's good. And I think when I heard you were leaving the Big Eye, I thought, well, Bill's got other things to do, like play music, which we'll talk about in a minute. But it sounds to me like you're still quite engaged in the world of policy language and claims disputes, and you're blogging, and so you really haven't retired. Maybe I had it wrong that you weren't going to anyway. Just wanted to segue into the next thing.
Well, my wife put it best when I told her I was getting ready to hit 65 years old, and when I told her that I was planning on retiring from the Big Eye, she said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to set me up a website. I'm going to start blogging. I'm going to write books. I'm going to do little speaking and stuff like that." She said, "In other words, you're going to keep doing exactly what you've been doing, but you won't get a paycheck." Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Right. But are you having fun? I think that's important too, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I love this stuff, and I think, at least I hope, when I speak to people about this, that enthusiasm shows through. I spoke to Gamma Iota Sigma's their annual convention the last 2 years. In fact, just spoke to a group of college insurance students at Middle Tennessee State University very briefly yesterday. And, you know, I try to tell them what a great industry this is. It's early in my career, I found myself apologizing a lot when I'd be at a party or something that somebody would say, "What do you do for a living?" I'd, you know, kind of lower my head and mumble that it was I worked in insurance. But I haven't done that in a long, long time because it's hard to think of an industry more critical and important than the insurance industry. We make everything else possible just about from a business or commerce standpoint. You can't buy a home, you can't build a home, you can't start and run a business without insurance to protect you.
That's true. And are you still on the speaking circuit?
A little bit. I'm cutting back. When I published my book, I did quite a bit. I was on the road. I've always been on the road for the last 40 years, but I was really on the road a lot promoting the book. And I've got, I can do seminars and presentations anywhere from an hour to 12 hours on the book. So I did a lot of that, but I am now almost 69 years old, and I've had enough of airports. So I'm being very selective now in what I do, and I jacked up my fees so to try to discourage people from hiring me. So I still do some of it, but just not as much.
Yeah, jacking up the fees is one way to limit the inbound. But Bill, it's interesting how you poured your life into this, you know, this whole concept of RTFP, and I wonder, like, maybe you could help me understand this. There, a lot of E&O claims have to do more with lack of communication or poor communication by agencies and their staffs with prospects and customers, and less to do with actual policy language. From what I understand from your compadre, Chris Amrine, anyway, that there's a lot of just failure to communicate about the endorsement or you know, was it your intention to not have earthquake and things like that? And yet, so that's more of like the softer science of marketing communications with customers and prospects and less about technical things. I also know that insurance is a technical industry, and the people who run agencies are very, you know, a lot of them are incredibly smart, a lot of designations like you have, and they understand the policies quite well, and some of them are very good at certain niches and really knowing the program or the coverage suite that they're offering, you know, people who have horses or whatever they're doing. So how do you reconcile this need to do the softer, maybe right brain communication with people and the left brain rational, you know, like I understand what's in the CGL update, you know, ISO's update to the CGL policy. Like how does this all in your mind play out?
Well, it's, you know, I'll tell you something, and it won't sound, at least at the outset, like it has anything to do with what you're talking about, but I get back to a lot of this begins with the way the industry advertises. It drives me nuts. And when I usually blog about technical coverage issues, I usually my blog that it's emailed at has a personal lines coverage or claim issue and a commercial lines one. But every now and then I'll throw in another blog post or two about things that interest me. And one of them is InsurTech, which I've blogged quite a bit about. When I post on LinkedIn, especially LinkedIn Pulse, you can see who is reading your mm-hmm. posts. And one InsurTech that I've blogged about quite a bit is Lemonade. And it's funny, I'll post about Lemonade, and within 20 minutes, I will see a dozen hits from Lemonade, so that I don't know if they're following me or they've got some kind of software that's tracking me or whatever. But I give InsurTech a hard time for other things. But it gets back to insurance advertising. When you look at the image that consumers have of the industry, it's based almost exclusively on what they see from our advertising. And we know there are a small group of companies that dominate, especially television advertising. Almost all of it is price focused. Almost all of it. In fact, I did a blog post called "What's So Funny?" and it was based on a tweet from some guy. I have no idea who he is, but he wanted to know why insurance companies and their advertising are always trying to outfunny each other. And, you know, to me, what we do isn't funny. I mean, people's lives are destroyed because of catastrophic losses that they have that could have been covered by people that knew what they were doing. So when we look at the advertising, it's almost all price focused. You got somebody with a price gun that can you can choose whatever price you want, or it's something kind of silly. But again, price focus. And the implication is that insurance is a commodity. It's all the same. A homeowner's policy is a homeowner's policy. Auto coverage is auto coverage. And when you RTFP, you will find often dramatic differences in coverage, which demonstrates why prices are sometimes lower for some products or carriers. So you'll discover things like that when you actually read the policy or recognize that carriers have different claims practices. Much of it's anecdotal as to who covers what, or there's one company that I've heard for years that if they have a liability claim involving one of their customers who negligently ran into somebody else in their vehicle, that they will try to find the other party 10 or 20% comparatively negligent so that they can reduce claim payments, liability payments by X percent. I don't know if there's any truth to that or not. That's why I say it's anecdotal. But it gets back to the focus that consumers get from us almost exclusively is price-based, with the implication being that it's all the same. And that's why it's so important to communicate to people, I think, first of all, through our advertising. And I give credit to carriers that make an effort, you know, like the Farmer series of commercials. At least they're talking about coverage examples. That their policy may cover something that another one doesn't. But I think it, from a communication standpoint, it begins with that platform of communicating and then carries forward from there, particularly in the claims process. That's a big problem for our industry in communicating that process.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, since this is my podcast, I guess I can – take it in a very, very clumsy segue direction, but what the heck. You mentioned, and folks don't know this by how Bill talks. He's in Tennessee and Nashville area and Music City and all that. So let's start out, Bill, by you explaining who are the Spiders.
The Spiders is kind of the third evolution of a band. One of my bucket list things when I retired was I wanted to be in a band. The last time I was in a band was in college in 1973. And so that was something I wanted to do. I was in a band. I graduated. I was actually an engineer is how I got into the industry, and didn't touch a guitar for 18 years. In the 90s, I got interested in playing some blues, did that for a little while. Then joined the Big Eye National to build a virtual university. I had no time for anything else for a long time, so I didn't touch a guitar for another 18 years. So when I retired, I decided that I would try to get a band going. So I got some guys together. We called ourselves the Old Dogs. We practiced for a while. We never played anywhere. Our bass player quit, then our band leader and singer quit. We found another bass player, then another singer, and we reformed as a band called Slingshot, did one gig, and then we got rid of our drummer, who was pushing 80 at the time. In fact, he used to play with Buddy Holly.
Oh, my goodness.
Great drummer, but it just his stamina wasn't quite there for us to be gigging regularly. So anyway, we ended up getting another drummer, and in the meantime, we lost another bass player and had to replace them. We're now known as the Spiders. That's S-P-Y-D-E-R-S. You can find us online at thespidersband.com, and we're also on Facebook and YouTube. But we play classic rock, and we write originals. We've got about 8 or 9 original songs. We played last year at the legendary Kimbrough's Pick and Parlor in Franklin, Tennessee, where people
like Vince
Gill and Emmylou Harris and Leon Russell and John Prine and Kid Rock and others have performed. We've been there three times last weekend. Most recently, we play this coming Friday night at a different venue, and then we play Saturday night at another one. So that's where much of my time that's not being spent dealing with insurance stuff is being devoted.
Yeah, that's really cool. So I guess we can, speaking of Facebook, talk about a post you put up, and a couple of other people have done it too. And it's just kind of a fun little game, you know, about concerts. Concerts we've seen, first, best, only, worst, whatever. Let's go down this list, and then you tell me your answer. If you forget it, I have it in front of me here, and I'll give you my answer. How about that?
All right, sure.
Okay, first concert.
My first concert was actually, it was 1969. It was a festival, and the first Nashville Pop Festival, but the headliner, the main thing, was a band called Grand Funk Railroad.
Yeah, they were great. They are, I have a number of their recordings live and studio, real good stuff. And mine was in 1975. The first one, shall we say, I remember was in 1975, and that was on New Year's Eve. And there was a bunch of bands, including one of my favorites, Blue Oyster Cult. But Kiss was the headliner, and Kiss came out I believe it was 75. I might have the year wrong. But Kiss came out and did a countdown because of New Year's Eve, you know, and they said 10:09, you know. And I looked at my watch, it was 12:20, and no one seemed to even notice or care.
Yeah.
That was at the Nassau Coliseum out in Long Island. That was,
Yeah, the Spiders don't do any Kiss songs or Blue Oyster Cult.
Oh, okay.
We do other stuff. We do Billy Idol and Foo Fighters and things like that, but we just don't happen. I don't look good in makeup. It's one reason.
There you go. Or the leather might be a little rough on you, too, the leather outfits.
Yeah.
All right, last concert.
Oh, boy, let me think. Well, I guess the last one was last week. I went to see a British guitar player by the name of Davy Knowles.
Okay.
Band called Backdoor Slam, and now he's a solo act, a three-piece band.
Okay, yeah, your post was Justin Hayward. That must have been the one before that.
Yeah, I saw Justin Hayward, I guess, about a month or so ago.
Okay, last Saturday I saw Lumineers in Charlottesville, Virginia. That was my last one. They were really good.
Yeah.
We don't
do any Lumineers either.
I'm suspecting a lot of mine you have not done. There might be a couple that you've done. Okay, best concert. You said REO Speedwagon.
Yeah, in fact, that was probably about 10 years ago. You know, these guys are up in their 70s now.
Mm-hmm.
And I took my son, he was in college at the time, to see them at a fairly small venue in Nashville. And they were awesome. I mean, I'd taken him and some of his buddies a few years earlier to see Green Day in a big venue in Nashville, and they were good. I mean, I love Green Day. In fact, the Spiders do some Green Day, but REO just put on a show. I mean, they knew how to work the audience. They knew how to make everybody have a good time and get involved. That's one thing we try to do as the Spiders. We do a lot of stuff that people will sing along with or dance to or at least tap their foot to. But REO, they just put on a great show. And
they got a lot of
songs. They were
as
good as they were back in 1970, 71.
Yeah, that skinny little lead singer is just, I mean, energy is like a little bit like Mick Jagger. You know, he's all over the place. Well, my best concert was Frank Zappa at the Palladium in New York City in Halloween 1977. We got tickets for all three shows that weekend. And the next criteria is worst concert. You said none, but I have Frank Zappa at the Palladium Halloween 77 because we went to all three shows, and one of the shows he decided, because Frank was Frank, and he decided he was going to do his conducting thing. So the entire show had his back to the audience. He was conducting his band in a lot of weird arrangements, and it was the strangest thing. It was like almost like a, hey, I know some of you guys are coming every night, so I'm just going to have fun with this and do something entirely different. But people were very upset with him.
Yeah, I saw him with the Mothers of Invention back in the early 70s. An incredible musician, but what he does isn't for everybody. You know, hey, I just thought of a worse concert. I saw Eric Gales, who's a blues player in Nashville, and it wasn't really his fault. His entire band had the flu.
Oh.
And they really probably should have canceled and rescheduled, but they tried to put the show on. And it was at the City Winery, which is a great venue. I have regular seats at a table right next to the stage. So he was hacking and coughing the whole time, and you could see the spittle flying through the air and settling down around our table. So I was lucky.
Oh, that's special.
Yeah.
Thanks for that story, Bill.
The closest that something like that's ever happened before is I saw Leslie West when he was with West.
Oh, yeah. Mountain.
Playing,
yeah.
And I stood right at the stage, and he sweat all over me.
Yeah, yeah. He was like Meatloaf, just a big, sweaty man.
Yeah,
but
that's why they
called him
Man Mountain.
Yeah, yeah, but he could play some good guitar, if I recall.
One of my favorite guitar players, yeah.
All right, loudest concert. You said
loudest
Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, I've been two or three of those, but Zeppelin, I saw them, I think it was their third U.S. tour, and there was only one song they did that I actually recognized. That was the Immigrant Song because of the distinctive vocal. Everything else was just feedback and buzzing and popping and stuff. It was just incredibly loud. Whoever did their sound should have been drawn and quartered.
Yeah, it was probably illegally loud. Well, I was subjected to the Nine Inch Nails concert. I don't know what year it was, but it was a small venue, too, and I thought I was going to die. You know, that phrase about your ears are going to bleed, I mean, I think they literally were. Okay, the act you've seen the most, you said Eric Johnson.
Yeah, in fact, I'll be seeing him in a couple of weeks again.
Okay. Well, since I'm a Jersey boy, mine, especially living some time in Freehold, mine was Bruce Springsteen, and I saw him at the Barn, which is was Rutgers University's old, you know, basketball court arena, really small, more like a high school size before they built the larger one they're in now. But saw him there and seen him outdoor venues, indoor venues. The Capitol Theater in Northern Jersey was probably the best venue I've seen him at, probably a dozen times there. He's just 4 hours of constant music. The guy's been just amazing.
Yeah, I've never seen him. But it's kind of like I saw a concert back in the 70s with the Grateful Dead, New Riders, the Purple Sage, and I think Poco. And the concert literally got over at daybreak. It started that night about 8 or 9 o'clock. They played all night long, and the stage was this vast sea of long-neck empty beer bottles.
Oh, that's a great story.
But it was just hours. I mean, they jammed for like 3 or 4 hours just on one thing after another. It was incredible.
That's great. Okay. Trying to wrap up here, but I love this conversation. Most surprising concert you said was Kenny G.
Yeah, my wife was a big Kenny G fan. She insisted that I take her to see him at the Opry House next to the Opryland Hotel, and it was incredible. He had an amazing band. You know, there's an old joke that you go into a room and you have in the room is like Adolf Hitler, Idi Amin, and Kenny G, and you have a gun with two bullets. What do? And the answer is you shoot Kenny G twice. Old musician joke, but that's what a lot of musicians think of his music, but I've always thought his music was pretty good, and the show was just awesome.
It's, and for me, the most surprising, I went grudgingly to this. I'm sure you've heard of Pat Metheny.
And, oh, yeah, I've seen him many times.
Yeah, he it was his, the show, the tour was the album that had Long Train Home, that song, and people can listen to it. It's a really compelling song. But the band was great, and I was really happy my friend talked me into going to see it. I was at the Capitol Theater too. Okay, next concert you're going to? You said Davy Knowles.
I just went to Davy Knowles, but
okay.
I've got my calendar here in my hand. My next concert, I got a bunch of them in March, will be Joe Bonamassa. We're traveling
Love
to
him.
Chattanooga. I've seen him several times. So I see him. Then right after that, the next week, I see a guy named Andrew Rip. The next day, I see Mark Letary, who was with a band called Snarky Puppy. The next week, I see a local band called Six Wire that's awesome. Mm-hmm. And then that weekend, I see Eric Johnson again.
Yeah, see, there. I don't even know why I'm asking you what you're doing these days, because that there you go right there.
Yeah,
Joe's got a he's a kind of a DJ on the Sirius XM Bluesville station, and
yeah, I don't have that.
He plays some really good stuff, including some newer blues stuff, along with older favorites. But he's a fun DJ, as it were.
Yeah, he does a couple, at least one, maybe two blues cruises. I think they're going to the Mediterranean this year, and they've gone to the Caribbean. And he has all of these great blues artists. In fact, if you want, for anybody who's not familiar with him, go on YouTube and search for Joe Bonamassa, Eric Gales, and it'll be one of the first ones that comes up. It's him and Eric Gales having like a guitar duel on a song that's just remarkable.
Okay. My next one is a cover band, a tribute band, called Brit Floyd. I don't know if you've heard of Brit Floyd, but if anybody likes any Pink Floyd song, these guys it is literally like you're listening to Pink Floyd. They don't do live iterations of the songs. They do the studio iterations, and they're absolutely spot on, the vocals, including these three female vocalists who are just outstanding. Because a lot of songs on Dark Side of the Moon where there's some really high end vocals going on, and just love them. I see them once a year in different places.
There's a local Nashville band called Eagle Maniacs that do Eagle stuff, and mm-hmm. like you say, if you close your eyes,
yeah,
you Eagles.
Yeah, right. Okay, wish you had seen. You said Gary Moore.
Yeah, he's my favorite guitar player.
And I had a real hard time with this because there's so many. I feel, I'm younger than you a little bit, Bill, but I feel like I missed some of the fun stuff. I would have loved to see Peter Frampton in the old days, especially that album, Frampton Comes Alive. That tour sounded just really outstanding. But
yeah,
then I thought
tour.
About it. Yeah. Oh, you did? I see. There you go.
It was as good as you would have imagined it to be.
Mm-hmm. Just a great guitarist. Incredible. But then I was thinking, you know, there's so many you could put in this category, including, like, I always wanted to see, I wish I had seen Cream, like a live Cream concert would have been really cool. Although I did see Clapton a number of times. I would have loved to see that band. And then I would have loved to see the original, like one of these London, like venues where I could have seen The Who, because I'm such a fan of Keith Moon. And of course, I just like drummers. And so Neil Peart's another one with Rush. But those two guys, I guess the 80-year-old drummer with spiders probably wouldn't have fit this category. Just amazing talent. Just amazing, amazing talent, those two guys.
Well, I have a real quick Peter Frampton story. My son bought a condo in an area of Nashville called the Gulch. It's in a high rise.
Oh, yeah.
And he the first week he's there, he goes down to get his mail, and a guy walks up next to him, and he looks over, and it's Peter Frampton. He has a condo there because it's near Music Row. And so I'm sure he doesn't live there, but he probably stays there when he's doing recording and stuff. And the probably the most interesting thing was my son is a millennial, just the fact that he knew who Peter Frampton was probably surprised Frampton.
That's great. Yeah. It's funny. My two millennial kids are really digging the original music. I don't know what you would call it, but I just call it real music because I try
no,
to listen.
I mean, the Spiders, we're kind of old guys, but we have a lot of young people that come to our stuff, and they know the words to, you know, to these old Beatles songs and the Doors, mm-hmm. and the classic rock, because it's classic. If it's great music, it's great music regardless of when it was recorded.
That's so true. Well, Bill, we're out of time. I enjoyed talking with you as always. Thanks for all you're doing for the industry. And I hope the folks listening, myself included, will get down in the Nashville area and catch the Spiders at an upcoming show sometime.
Yeah, you can see us Friday night at the Brew House West in Nashville.
That's great. All right, my friend, you take care.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
This has been On Point with Peter Van Aartrijk, a podcast presentation of Wells Media Group.